is following the teachings of the Buddha a philosophy or a religion?
Well, I think these terms don't quite overlap. Go to Thailand, go to a Buddhist wat, go to Japan, go to a temple in Tokyo, and tell me that that's not religion.
It's religion.
Now, is that what the Buddha originally had in mind? That's another question. But the fact is that for whatever reasons, right or wrong, misguided or guided, that is how the tradition has unfolded, and that's how it's functioned and operated in Buddhist cultures. And I think it's slightly churlish and also a bit precious to say, well, that's not what Buddhism really should be. That's what it is.
Mm.
And if there hadn't been monasteries and institutions and monks and nuns and so on, I wouldn't have been able to do what I do now. I'm dependent upon those institutions having survived, whatever critical reflections I might offer to them now. So it's, for me, Buddhism is not really a religion. I'm not even sure I'm comfortable with the word religion. I don't think of myself as a religious person. But on the other hand, you know, I find myself sometimes doing things quite sincerely that would be perceived as religious behaviors. I like going on pilgrimage. Now, that's kind of a religious behavior, isn't it? That's not a philosophical thing. So I feel a relationship to this tradition, which, to some degree, is the source of my own philosophical reflections, my own practice as a practitioner of the Dharma, but also, in some contexts, I'm quite comfortable with being included within a community that would consider itself religious. So it's a difficult question to answer. It's one that's often asked. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good question, because it makes us think, well, what do we mean by these words? And I'm not sure either of those terms really captures the complexity of the word Dharma. I mean, we all use the word Dharma, but what does Dharma mean? It somehow entails, it has a moral dimension, a philosophical dimension, a spiritual dimension, a religious dimension, a cultural dimension. And yet it can't really be adequately reduced to any of them. That's my feeling. So I don't get too worked up about these points of definition anymore.
Because they're just concepts.
Well, yeah, they are just concepts, but concepts have meaning. And it may just be concepts, but they help myself and others understand what we're doing. And we use them, sometimes with a certain awkwardness, sometimes less so. Where are we? Okay, shall we? Yes?
I just have a question that I was about to ask.
Yes,
to give you a little space instead. It seems like Dharmakirti, is that its name?
Dharmakirti.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Dharma we know. Kirti means the well-known one.
Okay.
Kirti. It sounds Kirti Scottish. McKirti. Dharma McKirti.
But he's also sort of suggesting almost a dialectical relationship between the two.
Yeah, he is. Yeah,
you have to have a relative truth of this, for the pursuit of the absence of greed.
Mm-hmm, that's right, yeah.
To really experience at least glimmers of the ultimate truth of the phenomenological world without greed, ego, self.
Well, even greed and delusion are part of are ultimate truths.
Okay.
You see, they also are impermanent, they're causative, they're effective, very effective, they create all sorts of results.
Yeah.
So even greed, ignorance, confusion, these are, for Dharmakirti, paramata satya.
Oh, okay.
They're real.
Okay.
He's not saying these are illusory.
Then why isn't the awakened mind actually an ultimate truth?
It is. Because it's a mind. All minds are ultimate truths.
Okay.
Yeah, the Buddha's mind and your mind are equivalent in being ultimate truths.
But
they're causative, they're impermanent, and they are the, and they're not, they don't only exist because we can think about them, like the absence of an elephant in the room or the absence of a unicorn or whatever. So they have a kind of functional existence. Dhammakirti is perhaps a functionalist. Mm-hmm. He's concerned with what actually functions and works and has effects in the world. Whereas absences don't by themselves. But they are very useful ideas because by attending to those ideas, by aspiring to what they're describing, the absence of greed, let's say, that gives us something to work towards. But it's only useful if we actually find a way of being without greed and hatred in our real world. And then once these things have dropped away, they have no intrinsic value anymore. The absence of greed is only, it's like the absence, that's why I think this absence of a shed, it gets rid of something that's really been a problem and has really blighted my life. But once it's gone and I've got used to its absence, then I just get on with living. And I think it's the same with this idea of progressively maybe becoming less selfish, less greedy, etc. We don't sort of sit back and say, wow, I'm not greedy. Wow, I'm not an egoist. Isn't that an amazing thing? We just get on with life. And again, this to me, it's all congruent with the idea that I'm going to come to in a minute, that the aim of the whole practice, the aim of the Dhamma, is the cultivation of the Eightfold Path. And this is where I would see the basis for... See, I find all of these ideas that I'm putting out to you as really the building blocks for what we might consider to be an authentically lay practice. Whereas all of the things that I have difficulty with are the sorts of ideas that would be perhaps attractive to someone who's renounced the world, who's seeking some sort of spiritual enlightenment, and is not so concerned with the effectiveness of them, of their acts and deeds in the world itself. Mm-hmm. They may be positive and compassionate and so on, but they're still aimed at the stopping of rebirth, mm-hmm. at transcendence, at nirvana, as the ending of all suffering, which means not getting born anymore, mm-hmm. in this multi-life model. Mm-hmm. Once we take out the idea of multiple lifetimes, as I do, once we take out the idea of nirvana as some sort of unconditioned reality, once we take out the idea of an absolute truth that underpins the phenomenal world, once we recognize that the Buddha's awakening is not about any particular state or truth, but it is a complex of truths, it's a series of tasks, then we're very much back into a practice that deals with the contingencies and the exigencies, the demands of this life. So the Eightfold Path is a way of living in the world. And what is weird, I find, is that the way in which the Four Truths have been reinterpreted and reconfigured so that the third truth becomes the goal. Which is odd if you think about it. We're so used to thinking of it as the nirvana is the goal of the Eightfold Path. But why then isn't it placed as number four? We'll come back to this. But I think that that's the tension, that's the struggle perhaps, between seeing the practice of the Dhamma as aimed ultimately at nirvana and seeing the practice of the Dhamma as aimed primarily at the path itself. In other words, living in the world. And there I think you also begin to see a difference between, let's say, the ambitions of a mystical monk, mm-hmm. as opposed to a person who has to deal with actual life in the concrete, and for Dharmakirti, real world. Mm-hmm. But what I'm trying to do in a way is I'm trying to sort of, get back to some of these basic ideas and reconsider them in the light of our condition as lay people today. I'm not particularly interested in being critical of monks or nuns, and they do their thing. I admire that. But I find that very often what, as lay people, we are tacitly supposed to do is become, as it were, monks in lay clothing. Mm-hmm. that the good lay Buddhist is basically someone who embodies monastic-like qualities of detachment, of serenity, of calm, of, you know, wise words, a certain remove from, you know, the struggle with life itself. And I think that somehow not really acknowledging the difference between a person who lives in the world as opposed to one who, to some degree, has stepped out of the world. And that's the ascetic dimension in Buddhism, which has become, since the Buddha's time, increasingly normative. In other words, that's what your good Buddhist, that's the image we have of what the ideal Buddhist is. If you look at, you know, read any text, read it, the monk is the one who somehow is taking this thing seriously. The lay person, not quite. And if a lay person does traditionally, or even today, become, you know, an eminent figure within the Buddhist world, that's usually presented as having achieved that in spite of their lay status. In other words, the lay status is something that always has to be overcome in a way. And I don't think we live in that sort of reality anymore. You see, we have to see the monk-lay division, monastic-lay division, at the time of the Buddha, was to a considerable degree determined not by purely religious or philosophical or spiritual necessity, but by economic and social necessity. And that, I think, is a very important thing to grasp, whereas it's very often presented to us now that without becoming a monk, without renouncing the world, without taking orders, you'll be too entangled and mired in the mess of the world to really be able to train yourself in a kind of high-octane spiritual way. And so laity is seen as somehow necessary, because the monks have to eat and have monasteries and so on, but it's somehow secondary, it's somehow peripheral, it's not of the same level of authenticity or commitment. But again, I don't find that to be true. I don't know if any time you spent time in Buddhist monasteries in Asia, but, you know, they're not little oases of spiritual excellence. There's all sorts of nonsense going on in there. And again, there's a certain comfort, there's a certain security in the monastic life. And many people in Korea, for example, the monasteries function as a kind of, they have a social value function, in that people who can't cope with the world will become monks. So they're not becoming monks because they aspire to enlightenment. They can become monks because they can't hack modern-day Confucianist materialism of Korea. So the reasons are often negative as to why one becomes a monk. And we know also that in many societies, in Europe too, that for women, if they weren't married by a certain age, it was off to the nunnery. And that is, and certainly that's the case in many Asian countries. Nunneries are filled with women who are unable to get married for one reason or another. So again, the motive is often negative. So the monasteries and the nunneries have come to serve a social function more and more, and often that social function is a very valuable one in those kinds of societies. But to then assume that it's only within those contexts that any kind of serious practice and development can be done, I think is a mistake. I don't think that's true any longer at all. Often there's a certain complacency in the monastic environments, and sometimes even a certain holier-than-thou kind of attitude that creeps in.
Reliance on ritual.
Very often a reliance on ritual. And again, that's the way Buddhism has developed into a ritualized religion is also remarkable. I mean, there's certainly none of that at all at the Buddha's time. If you try to imagine yourself back into the world that is described in the suttas, there's no activity going on that we would call religious, with the possible exception that twice a month the monks, and that is arguably not the right word anyway, the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis would recite their rule, the upasata ceremony, or the patimokkha as they call it now. That was the only formal religious activity. There was no puja, there was no altars, there was no images, nothing. nothing that we would call overtly religious behavior. Same with the time of Jesus, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, in Galilee, in his time, you know, just a bunch of people trying to understand things. So I think it's inevitable, given the way human beings organize and develop their what they value most deeply, is it for some reason or another it develops into religious institutions, and they bring in their wake all the problems that go with any kind of institution, really, particularly if it thinks it's got the truth. Anyway, we won't start with a sitting because I know this is the worst time of the day for trying to sit quietly. It's the siesta session. So what I want to do, in a way, is come back to where we started this morning. And I think the different points that we've touched on already, I think are very helpful in somehow having laid out the ground for what I'm going to be doing now. And I'm going to read this passage that I read at the very beginning of the day. As long as my knowledge and vision, so the Buddha speaking, was not entirely clear about the 12 aspects of these Four Noble Truths, I did not claim to have had a peerless awakening in this world. Now, to me, that is the starting point. That is where I think that is the basis upon which we can begin to rebuild an edifice of ideas, perhaps, that would give rise to a thoroughgoing lay, secular, humanist approach to the Dhamma. In other words, I think we have to rethink the core ideas rather than just following the traditional interpretations and giving them a kind of a lay secular spin. I think that's never going to get really to, that's not going to give us a firm enough foundation. So what are the 12 aspects of the Four Noble Truths? Does anyone know?
Probably.
It's a long list to remember. But it's not too difficult to remember because, in fact, it's three aspects for each truth, and the aspects are pretty much the same. Now, what is in the preceding passage, the Buddha enumerates what these 12 are. So I'll read out that passage. He says, "Such is suffering, first truth. It can be fully known. It has been fully known. Such is craving, second truth. It can be let go of. It has been let go of. Such is cessation." And remember, the Buddha defines cessation as the cessation of craving, not the cessation of suffering. This is a big problem in that, this word, cessation of suffering. The Buddha defines cessation as the cessation of craving, the ending of craving. Such is cessation. It can be experienced. It has been experienced. And then such is the path, the Eightfold Path, fourth truth. It can be cultivated or it can be created. It has been created and cultivated. Now, what's going on here? First of all, when we think of the truths in this way, they begin to sound less and less like truths. In other words, we generally think that something, you know, a proposition or a statement can be true. Like Albuquerque is Santa Fe is the capital of New Mexico. That is true. In other words, that actually corresponds to some state of affairs in the world that you can ascertain to be true or false. If you say Albuquerque is the capital of New Mexico, you might think that's true. But, in fact, it's not true. But that can be, you can check that out. That's in other words, that proposition or that claim can be demonstrated to be not true. Now, the Buddha's not using the word truth in that sense, quite clearly here. He's using the word truth more in the sense that William James might have used it, in a pragmatic sense. What the suffering, dukkha, is true, because if you relate to it in a particular way, if you fully know it, that can actually produce benefits in this world. In other words, it's a pragmatic definition of truth. And this, I think, is very, very important. And my book, Buddhism Without Beliefs, also starts on this same point, that the four truths are not four claims to represent a state of affairs in the world correctly. It's not a correspondence theory of truth, as the philosophers would say. But actually, the four truths are injunctions to act and live in a certain way, to do something. The four truths, therefore, become four tasks. And that, to me, is the key to reconfiguring this whole first sermon of the Buddha, is to recognize the truths as tasks to be performed. And each truth is a task that requires a different sort of performance. So when you look at this text, such is suffering, one, it can be fully known, two, it has been fully known, three, you get three aspects of the first truth, three aspects of the second, third, fourth, that makes 12. Is that clear? Now, what is it that he's doing in each little sub-clause? He's pointing out that suffering is something to be recognized. He's pointing out that the fully knowing of suffering is an action to be performed, something to be done. And he's pointing out that this is an action that you can actually accomplish. You can do it. And he's claiming, it has been done, I've done that, as it were. So in other words, you have recognition, performance, accomplishment of four tasks. Such as suffering, it can be fully known, it has been fully known. The second truth, craving, can be let go of. First we need to recognize what craving is. Then the challenge is, well, can this be dropped away? Can I let go of this? Can it be let go of? We'll come back to this point. Because clearly you can't just say to yourself, stop craving. Nothing much happens, as you might have tried this. Just let go. Well, that sounds like a very nice idea, but how do you do it? This is the real question. How do you let go of craving? There's no magical off switch in my brain somewhere where suddenly craving will just stop. We'll come back to that. Cessation of craving. This is something you can experience. The task is to experience the stopping of craving. The word in Pali literally means see it with your own eyes. See it for yourself. Know it for yourself. Experience the stopping, the absence, the letting go of craving, the what the Buddha calls the unconditioned, which sounds a bit awkward here. But in the terms that we described it this morning, it's this absence, it's this dropping off of something. And then the fourth truth, the path, the Eightfold Path, this is something to be brought into being. Bhavana is the word. And it has been brought into being, the Buddha then says. Now what is, again, another good example of how some of these key terms have been somehow prejudiced and biased in the favor of a kind of subjective spiritual practice alone is found in the word bhavana. In most Buddhist contexts, bhavana means to meditate. In other words, the emphasis is on meditation. If you're staying with a friend in Sri Lanka and they say, I'm going to do my bhavana now, they mean they're going to meditate. They're going to sit down cross-legged on the floor and watch their breath or generate metta or praise the Buddha or something. That's bhavana. But the Buddha uses the word bhavana for everything within the Eightfold Path. From the way we see things, think about things, speak, act, work, all of that is bhavana. All of that is to be brought into being, to be practiced, we would say.
Doesn't bhavana also mean becoming?
No, that's... let's break the words down. The word bhava, bhava can be translated as becoming, mm-hmm. or existence is closer. It comes from the Sanskrit root bhu, which is actually a cognate. In other words, it has a common root with the English word be, being. Bir, bhava, existence, bhava chakra, means the wheel of becoming or the wheel of being. Bhava is the 10th link in the 12 links. It's usually translated as becoming, but it actually means just existence or being. Bhavana turns it into a verb form, which means to bring into being, to bring into existence. So the path is something to be brought into existence, which in everyday English means to be created. To create something means to bring something that previously did not exist into existence. You create a work of art. You create a child. You create work opportunities. In other words, things that didn't exist at one point are brought into being. That's what the word bhavana literally means. And it's come to mean, weirdly, meditation. Which is odd, if you think about it. You couldn't possibly translate it as meditation here, because how do you meditate right livelihood? It doesn't make any sense. And so you'll find, like Bhikkhu Bodhi translates bhavana in this sort of context as mental development. So development is the idea. But again, this insistence on prioritizing mental. The word mental isn't in there at all. It just means to bring something into being, to create. Okay, now the next point, is this clear? Four truths are four tasks to be recognized, performed, and accomplished. But they're presented in a certain sequence. And I don't think this sequence is random. They're presented in a sequence that, as I understand it, shows that how the performance of the first task is the precondition for the second task. The performance of the second task is the precondition for the third, and the performance of the third is the precondition for the fourth. Okay. Now this is where I think the idea of dependent origination comes in. Let's look at the Buddha's definition of dependent origination. And we're not going to get into the 12 links, I'm afraid. We can do that later if you like. But it's basically another extension of the same principle. First of all, it's worth remembering that when the Buddha describes his process of leaving home, practicing asceticism, practicing meditation, rejecting both, remember. Rejecting asceticism, rejecting the practice of the jhanas, essentially. He then finds himself, you know, in a sort of dead end. And he then sits beneath the Bodhi tree and he then resolves his existential questions through the experience called awakening. Now, in that, when he describes the awakening in that text, it's called the Arya Pariyesan Sutta, the Discourse on the Noble Quest. It's the 26th middle-length discourse. When the Buddha describes his awakening, he describes that he has awoken to Iddha Paccayata Paticca Samuppada, this conditionality, conditioned arising, or dependent origination. I prefer conditioned arising. So in other words, he identifies very explicitly that his awakening was an awakening to conditioned arising. Now, conditioned arising, in a sense, is perhaps what we might call the E equals MC squared of the Dhamma. It is the core axiomatic starting point of the whole business. And again, I'll give you a couple of citations here. This is from Majjhima 28, where the Buddha sees the person who sees conditioned arising sees the Dhamma. The person who sees the Dhamma sees conditioned arising. In other words, the Dhamma, conditioned arising are synonymous. They mean exactly the same thing. And in fact, in his description of his awakening to conditioned arising, again, he says that this Dhamma I have reached is deep, hard to see, etc., etc. But people love their place. They delight and revel in their place And it is hard for people who love, delight, and revel in their place to see this ground, idam tannam, this conditionality, conditioned arising. He speaks of his awakening as a shift, a kind of existential shift from a life that is preoccupied with one's position, one's place, one's identity, one's role in society, one's beliefs, everything that's that serves to give you a sense of security in a radically insecure world. And we spend our time preoccupied with our place, our position. And the Buddha's awakening was one in which he let go of that. That all fell away. And he encountered his ground, his tanam. And the tanam he describes as conditioned arising. In other words, the unfolding causal process of life itself, what Dharmakirti calls the ultimate truth. But again, we have to be careful in using a word like ultimate truth because it suggests a certain stasis, a thing. Whereas conditioned arising is anything but a thing. It is a flow. And in fact, perhaps in everyday English, we might translate paticca samuppada simply as life. Life. Like the river of Heraclitus. The flow of life itself. One thing giving rise to another, giving rise to another, giving rise to another. And in another passage, he describes this... he describes conditioned arising in one level more of complexity. He's talking to a person called Udayin, who I think was probably a Jain. And he says, "Let be the past, Udayin. Let be the future. I shall teach you the Dhamma. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases." Now, this is a fairly famous passage. But what it shows is that really he's woken up to the fundamentally causative nature of life. That what we do creates effects. If we stop doing a certain thing, that particular effect will stop happening. And when we get to the four truths, we have the articulation of that principle translated into the path itself. So, if we think of the four truths as four tasks, then we can see how they are, as it were, a sequence of causes and effects. So, if you perform the task of fully knowing suffering, in other words, when there is the fully knowing of suffering, the letting go of craving will arise. When there is the letting go of craving, the cessation of craving will arise. When there is the cessation of craving, the creation of a path can arise or will arise. You see the point? And I can only understand the reason the Buddha presented the four truths in this way, 1, 2, 3, 4, because he saw them as four actions, one leading to the next, and culminating, not in nirvana, but in the path, the Eightfold Path. But if you think about it, it doesn't end with the path either. Because if you think of the Eightfold Path, you have first of all samadhiti, the way you see the world and yourself, then the way you think about it, the way you speak, the way you act, the way you live. In other words, it moves from the inner to the outer, seeing and thinking, to words, to deeds, to work. And then when you have that framework of hopefully an ethically grounded life based on a certain vision, then you have the possibility of cultivating mindfulness, cultivating concentration, which are the explicitly spiritual elements of the path. But the question, of course, arises, what are you mindful of? What do you concentrate on? And it seems to me that you are mindful of suffering. You are mindful of craving. You concentrate on the task of fully knowing suffering. So in other words, what he seems to be describing is a kind of feedback loop at which you're continuously involved in an ongoing process of responding to the world and the situations of the world in which you find yourself in a way that is framed by this perspective. So it's ongoing. There's no enlightenment, awakening. It's not some sort of moment. There may be moments at which you sort of have an aha, wake up, oh yes, of course. But that's not actually so important. The important thing is the extent to which you actually live these things out in your ordinary life continuously. And as you continue, your understanding and your stability, your attention becomes that much more integrated, that much more deepened into the fabric of your experience. So the Buddha's pointing very much here to a process. And again, he says it in, he's very clear. He says, only when I was entirely clear about the 12 aspects of the Four Truths did I claim to have a peerless awakening in the world. So what he has awoken to is a way of living in the world, a way of being in the world, that is very demanding, extremely demanding, particularly, and this is the point we perhaps need to dwell on, to fully know suffering. This is perhaps not something we find particularly attractive. But this, I feel, is of the essence of what the Buddha's about. Now, the question, of course, we have to answer is, well, what does that mean? What does the word fully mean? We all know, for example, let's look at his definition of suffering, first of all. Birth is painful, aging is painful, sickness is painful, death is painful. Encountering what is not dear is painful. Separation from what is dear is painful. Not getting what one wants is painful. This is a description of, we can all relate to this. And then he concludes and says, this psychophysical condition is dukkha, is painful. The trouble also is the word dukkha and how we translate it into English. I think suffering is not really good enough as a translation. I'm not sure any word in English really captures what this word dukkha means. And arguably we have to abandon trying to translate it and just get used to using the word dukkha, which I think probably amongst here, some I've noticed in Buddhist groups, they'll sometimes now say, "Oh, that's good example of dukkha." And you don't say a good example of suffering. You know that it's not equivalent. In some sense, occasions, yes. But dukkha extends further than just pain. For example, the Buddha says, sabba sankara dukkha. All conditioned things are dukkha. Now, this glass of water is a conditioned thing, but in what sense is it dukkha? I don't think it suffers pain. If I drop it on the floor, it's not going to go, ouch. So clearly, the Buddha, when he uses the word dukkha, doesn't mean just the unpleasant feeling we know as suffering or pain. At all. In fact, he would even describe pleasure as dukkha. Pleasure is dukkha. Happiness is dukkha. What does that mean? It's dukkha in the sense that, for a start, it's impermanent. This is, I think, again, a rather important point. That things are dukkha, even if they're wonderful, nice, joyous things, are dukkha because they ain't going to last. And this, of course, is implicit in the idea of dependent origination, of conditioned arising, that things are constantly unfolding, becoming something else, and then becoming something else. And this is really the core insight that underpins this whole process, is this sense of change. But it's not just chaotic change, random change, it's a kind of orderly change. But it's also acknowledging that every experience, everything that we can cling on to in the world, a glass of water is not a very good example, unless you're starving, unless you're in a desert.
We are.
Oh, of course, we are. This is a very precious thing.
But
again, yes.
I was just going to say, but I was thinking, if you tried to imagine the most exquisite pleasure that you individually as a person could experience, that's by definition, it's going to be impermanent.
It's going to be impermanent.
I mean, it is.
It is. And the problem is, we kind of know that. We all know that. We all know we're going to die. We all know we're going to get old and we're going to get sick and we're going to have all sorts of crap happen to us. But we don't really know it. The key is the word fully.
Yeah.
And this is where I think a number of things come into play. I've lost my train of thought. In what sense is this dukkha? It's dukkha in the sense that ultimately you can't rely on it for the kind of lasting pleasure you're constantly seeking. So I would translate dukkha in that sense as something like the undependability, the unreliability of things, the unsatisfactory nature of things, the imperfect nature of things, the flawed nature of things. There's nothing in this conditioned world, and the conditioned world isn't the only one we got. There's nothing here that we can rely upon to grant us the kind of lasting well-being that deep down we crave.
Yeah. It seems to me, and I don't know whether this is correct, but it seems to me that yes, impermanence, mm-hmm. right? And yes, deeply know mm-hmm. the impermanence. And yes, this is entirely beneficial.
Uh-huh.
But this, the kind of valence or spin that one senses, mm-hmm. that I sense in Buddhist or Indian,
mm-hmm.
Is that this facet of even the greatest and most ramified, important individual and social pleasures devalues them. Right, mm-hmm. And I think from a Western point of view, while that impermanence is a kind of tragic dimension,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't devalue the experience of these
mm-hmm.
necessarily impermanent and fleeting things,
mm-hmm.
right? Like family life.
Yeah, sure.
Or take from the Greeks the notion of the importance of the polis.
Mm-hmm. The city, the yeah, sure.
Yeah, so I don't know what you think about that, but for me, I find that it makes it hard for me to fully embrace this, because yes, impermanence, yes, insofar as I appreciate impermanence, that is highly beneficial to me, but no to the devaluation of that which
mm-hmm.
is fleeting.
Well,
these things that we in the lay world invest ourselves
mm-hmm.
in.
Well, wait till I get to the end of the thing. Because you see, this is a standard complaint about Buddhism, is because of this emphasis on dukkha. But the point is, we have to recognize that this fully knowing dukkha is not the aim of the exercise. That's where the exercise begins. The consequence of fully knowing dukkha is that we begin to let go of a certain kind of grasp or grip on things. And in letting go of that grasp or the grip, we open up the possibility of living from another perspective. And there, and this is why I feel that the Eightfold Path is the goal in a way. And that has to do with valorizing the whole of our life, but from another perspective. The problem with craving is not that it is the cause of suffering. I think that is another overlay. The problem with craving is that it inhibits us from living fully. It's a constrictive grip, a Mara-like grip, that prevents us from opening up into a flourishing life. Now, okay, perhaps I'm reading in certain Western preferences into this interpretation of the text, but remember what I spoke of last night, the idea that the Four Noble Truths are the template for a new kind of city.
Yeah. Well, I guess my question comes down to whether whether the notions of Buddhism are elastic enough to allow a more Western, if you will.
Well, this is, of course, the great question, and this is what I'm trying to do, and maybe they're not elastic enough. I sometimes think of traditional Buddhism as like a patient in need of very severe surgery. And I'm not sure the patient will survive the operation. In other words, if we do what I'm trying to do to this material, am I going to compromise it in such a degree that it will cease to be Buddhism? It will become something else. Fine. But it may no longer, it could be that Buddhism is so committed, or that idea is so embedded in a certain cultural perspective we call Asian or Eastern or whatever, that it may not be possible to wrest it free from that matrix. At that point, I think we need to pause and look at how Buddhism has already undergone transformations, particularly in the Far East. You see, when we again, this is one of these problems of this idea Asian. Indian culture and Chinese culture are as different one from the other as both of them are from Western culture. You can't usefully describe them as some monolithic East. They're totally different. When Buddhism went into China, it went into a situation as different as it is coming into now from compared to what it started out with, Indian thought. In fact, we have two kinds of Buddhism. We have Indo-Tibetan Buddhism. In other words, everything that's remained, as it were, within the framework of Indian thought, cosmology, and so on, which is equally true in Tibet as it is in Thailand or Burma. And then you have East Asian Buddhism. Now, what happened in the Far East is, I think, comparable to what could potentially happen in modernity. Now, in the Far East, we gave rise, for example, to Zen. Now, here is a culture that is not at all world-denying, I feel. In fact, it's one that has allowed, for example, a whole aesthetic tradition to emerge. If you look at Pure Land Buddhism, the way in which it was understood by Shinran and Honin, a whole social dimension was embraced. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, it took on all sorts of other rather odd ideas about Amitabha Buddha and whatnot, but it also was a movement that broke out of the monasteries. Shinran disrobed. Shinran is a sort of Luther-like figure. Now, in the Vipassana world, we're not really very aware of these movements. We're not very aware of the work of someone like Nichiren, for example, or the Soka Gakkai, modern religious movements in Japan that have their origins in 13th century Japanese religious thinking, the Tendai school. So I think when we have to be careful not to be too limited by the sense of Buddhism we get from within the Theravada or the Tibetan schools. And also even Zen has become rather sort of self-centered, I feel, in some ways. But to recognize that particularly in East Asia, Buddhism has undergone extraordinary transformations. It doesn't sit very happily with the kind of Buddhism that's often thought of as normative in the sort of circles we're in now, which we tend to think of Theravada, Zen, Tibet. Where's Pure Land? Where's Tiendai? They're not mentioned. We don't know anything about them. We don't realize that the largest Buddhist group for non-Asians in America is Soka Gakkai. Half of you probably haven't even heard of Soka Gakkai. Right? Huge movement. And it's not about meditation. It's not about spiritual renunciation. It's about engaging with the world. It's the largest Buddhist group. It's the Buddhist group that has the largest number of people of color, of working class people, creates all sorts of social networks.
Can you spell that one?
S-O-K-A, Soka. Gakkai, G-A-K-K-A-I. It has a political party in Japan. They were recently in government. Yeah.
Oh, it just seems like everything you're talking about in the last few minutes comes back to your original question that you've been looking at for a number of years, which is, what is Buddhism?
Yes, it does come back.
If you're going to destroy the patient through your inquiries and through going back to who the Buddha was, well, what is Buddhism?
Well, you see, the point is, I would argue that my my reading of these materials is going back to very primary sources. See, this business of the four truths as four tasks. This is the culmination. I've translated it quite literally. It's the culminating passage of the Buddha's first sermon. Now, you can't get more orthodox than that. And yet, you can look high and low in the Pali canon or the Tibetan canon. They never talk about these four things. They're not there. They're forgotten. This is what's weird. You would have thought that Buddhists would have spent a lot of time asking, what does it mean to fully know suffering? Try and find me a single passage that even addresses that point or uses that term to consider that point. Let alone the idea... See, I think the four truths have been reconfigured into a way that suits the aims of people who seek to transcend the world and achieve nirvana. So the first truth is suffering. The second truth is the cause of suffering. Philologically, that is apparently suspect. The third truth is called the cessation of suffering. But yet when the Buddha defines it, he defines it as the cessation of craving. Two quite different things, I think. And the fourth truth is the Noble Eightfold Path that leads to the cessation of suffering. I think that template, suffering, cause of suffering, ending of suffering, path leading to the ending of suffering, is a superimposition on what were originally four tasks, one which led to the next. That is so much an orthodox idea. Suffering, cause of suffering, end of suffering, path leading to the end of suffering. Can you actually consider something that doesn't accept that view, that interpretation, as Buddhist? I don't see why not. Particularly when you have a primary source in the very same text, a section of the text which is the conclusion of it, where the Buddha says, this is how I experience my awakening. And yet, something completely ignored. It's weird. I find that very, very weird. I found one other sutta so far in which these terms, fully knowing suffering, letting go of craving, experiencing cessation, cultivating the path, are found. And they were twisted around. They'd substituted the fourth truth, the third truth became the fourth truth. It said you cultivate the path and which leads you to the experience of cessation. It was literally twisted around. I can track it down for you if you're interested. So my sense is, in coming back to these primary materials, we do have a text going back to the earliest stratum on which I feel that we can rethink what the Buddha's doing. Now, if the Soka Gakkai or Pure Land Buddhism can be seen to be Buddhism, where they're not even based, they don't even read these texts, they're based on Mahayana sutras, which post-date the Buddha by about 500 years, at least, which are highly dubious as anything similar to what the Buddha himself said, and yet are considered to be mainstream Buddhism, then I would argue that this has probably got a sounder basis in tradition than those. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Well, I was just going to inquire, there are a lot of practices, though, that are aimed at fully meeting your suffering.
Yeah, no, that is true.
Kanlin, Kuan Yin, compassion, So, even though they're not...
But are they framed in the context of the four truths? They're not. I've done Donglen practice. And, there's endless discussion about this, and also just meditating on dukkha, meditating on impermanence. But what I'm saying is that the purpose of those practices is not understood in the framework of the four truths. They're taken out of this framework and seen as more in terms of ways whereby one can finally lead to understandings that will liberate you from the cycle of birth and death. In other words, what I'm arguing is that we can find in these early sources another template within which we can then rethink exactly the same practices. Yeah, of course. Donglen, for example, wonderful thing to do. But what is the context in which it is meaningful? Why do you do it? That has to be the question. And normally the answer to why you do it will then slip back into, well, if it's Mahayana Buddhism, then in order to continue through all of my lifetimes until all sentient beings are free from samsara, and then I can jump off then I can get out of samsara too. See, all Mahayana Buddhism does, for all of its talk about endless compassion, is basically about trying to stop life. It's not a life-affirming philosophy at all. Mahayana Buddhism is just saying, there's so much suffering in the world, I can't go and attain nirvana myself first if I don't attend to the suffering of all others. So I will stay here until everybody else is free, and then I will become free. But the aim is the same, stopping of life, not getting reborn, except not just for me, but for everybody. Now, I would question that whole way. That way of thinking for me is meaningless. I can't accept that worldview.
But lay people who haven't taken the bodhisattva vow, maybe they practice Tonglen just to expand their own.
Of course, any individual practitioner can be doing these things for a million different reasons. And particularly in the West, I think a lot of Buddhist practitioners are not really terribly interested in what I'm doing is basically theology. Right? There's no theos, but it's theology. Basically, it's closer than philosophy, what I'm doing. Most Buddhist practitioners, I would suggest, maybe I'm being arrogant, have not really got a very worked out theological framework for their practice. What they find is that by doing, let's say, the practice of Donglen, this meets an emotional, moral need. It is a practice that focalizes and concentrates those concerns about the suffering of the world, but in a way that somehow meets their particular individual needs at a particular time in their lives. It may be part of a practice that makes them feel more bonded with people of their particular group or circle, and the long-term theological implications don't really matter to them. And fair enough. I mean, I don't wish it upon anybody to be a theologian.
So, from what I understood, what you said is that meeting the first truth, fully comprehending or understanding or meeting suffering, is to comprehend the futility of, you know, craving this and getting it, it's not being satisfactory.
That's what I think it leads to. I think the fully knowing suffering, on the one hand, I think it does entail a more reflective, more meditative, a more honest embrace of the conditions of one's own life. And yet, so much of our time we spend basically avoiding that. And when you sit in meditation, when you practice mindfulness, when you just are aware of the breath, the body, why is that so difficult? Why is it that at a certain point the mind will go off into any kind of silly story rather than just attend to the fact of your existence? Fully knowing suffering, I think the practice of mindfulness is a practice of fully knowing dukkha. The practice of vipassana literally means to be attentive to impermanence, suffering, not self. That's vipassana in the traditional definition. So that is simply a way of dukkha parinyana, fully knowing dukkha. But what's the point of that? What's the purpose of it? I would argue that the purpose of it is that it begins to weaken the habitual strategies we have for trying to get what we like and hold on to them, trying to get rid of what we don't like, and just, in other words, to try to manipulate and to control the events of our world and also our inner emotional life, for example, trying constantly to manufacture and constellate a perfect or neo-perfect situation. If we start to experience our lives from the perspective of our mortality, and if we really get to feel that deep in our bones, then many of these strategies of grasping and rejecting will no longer really be seen to be to have much point. They won't really be considered to be effective or even intelligible. because we've touched into a deeper truth. I mean, let me give you an example. When I was a Tibetan Buddhist monk, one of the meditations we had to do on a daily basis was to contemplate our own death. And this wasn't visualizing stuff or meditating on the bardos or anything. It was simply recognizing, it was reflecting every day that there's only one thing certain in our life, and that is we will die. Everything else is uncertain in the future. The only thing the future holds for us with certainty is our own end. You meditate on that, you think about it, you reflect about it until it begins to sort of sink in. Then you meditate on the fact that this one certain thing could happen at any time. The time of death is uncertain. So this is a paradox. I mean, Heidegger also gets into this. The one certain thing is uncertain as to when it will occur. In other words, you're always living kind of on the edge. This might be our last day here. Yeah, we all go, it may actually be true. And when then this does happen, and it does. I mean, I got an email the other day. Oh, Barry's died. Oh, God, terrible. Barry, God, he was so young. We don't really get that, in a sense. Now, what I found in practice by doing this meditation on death is it doesn't make me gloomy and morbid. It actually makes me more and more aware of how extraordinary it is to be alive at all. And so curiously, this apparent negative perception in practice becomes an affirmation and a celebration of life itself. And again, you look at a lot of Buddhist, look at the Dalai Lama. I mean, he's a fairly cheerful sort of guy. Yeah, he's got this terrible crisis of his country, ignored by the world. And yet that doesn't seem to compromise his basic joie de vivre. And I feel that the meditation on death actually leads us into a deeper kind of joy and an awareness of this fully knowing suffering. Let me give you a very good example of this from the Buddha himself. I do not say, says the Buddha, that the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths is accompanied by suffering or displeasure. It is accompanied only by happiness and joy. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very striking passage.
Where is that passage from, Stephen?
Samyutta Nikaya 5, section 441. You might have noticed that a lot of my citations are from the Samyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses. I don't have the page number in the English translation.
So I just wondered, because it didn't sound like it was from the sermon at Sarnath.
No, it's not at the sermon at Sarnath. The final book of the connected discourses is called the Satcha Samyutta, the connected discourses on the truths, on the four truths. It's where the whole two volumes of text concludes, is on the Four Noble Truths. It's where it ends. And this is one of the passages there. I do not say the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths is accompanied by suffering or displeasure, which you might well think it is, given the fact that we're supposed to fully know suffering, but it's accompanied only by happiness and joy. Now, something strange is going on here. Something very strange is going on here. So, and again, if we spin this out a little bit further, this fully knowing suffering also, inevitably, I feel, takes you beyond your own suffering into an increasing awareness of the suffering of the world. And it's particularly if when you practice vipassana, when you practice this attention to impermanence, attention to dukkha, attention to not self, that this very process begins to wear down, begins to erode that enclosed boundary of me. You see, I think this idea of not-self is not just, when the person who has gained insight into selflessness has not just achieved some sort of, some better cognitive understanding of himself or herself, but has also begun to break down the anesthetic quality of self. Self-clinging or self-grasping is a kind of protective device to seal us off from the pain of others. And as one begins to probe openly into what this suffering that characterizes life is about, you move beyond the limits of your own self-concern and the concern of your immediate circle and begin to open up to what the Buddha calls the suffering of sabbasatta, all sentient beings. And here you get the practices of metta, karuna, which are equally a practice of fully knowing suffering. This is where metta and vipassana and satipatthana all have in common that they are different strategies for fully knowing dukkha. All of them. I would argue even that Zen koan practice is a way of fully knowing dukkha. And as one begins to fully know dukkha, instead of leading you into gloom and doom, it actually opens you up to the reality of life itself and to the suffering of others. I think there's an empathetic dimension that begins to open up. I think there's an aesthetic dimension to this, as well as a transformation of your sense of who you are as a person, you know, what you are as an organism. So for me, the wisdom and compassion start here in the first noble truth. They're not some distant goals. And as we do this, what we're doing basically is we're fundamentally reorienting what is of primary concern in our lives. We more and more does our sense of being in the world come to be characterized by our sense of impermanence, the overall tragic nature of life, the fact that none of these phenomena are intrinsically can be owned or possessed. And that offers us another perspective altogether, one that quite naturally leads to a falling away of those habits of behavior, greed, hatred, delusion, etc., that are premised on a world that is made up of endless discrete objects that exist for my pleasure or my displeasure. So what the Buddha is doing, I think, is asking us to actually reconsider ourselves and our world in a radically new way. To turn our attention to these things in such a way that other possibilities of relating to the world, relating to other people, begin to open up. And so I think it then follows quite naturally in a way that once those... in other words, you don't let go of craving by telling yourself, don't crave. That's not going to work. What you need to do is to let go of craving, for craving to fall away, you need to understand what it is that is the condition for the falling away of craving, which is the fully knowing of dukkha. The craving will then begin to... that grip will be released. I'm not saying it'll vanish overnight. It will probably always be there to some extent, because craving is, I think, undeniably built into our neurobiological organism. It's not some mental property. It's always going to be around to some degree. But we can begin more and more to experience the world minus that impulse, minus that urgency to get rid of. And when we get those moments in which there really is a stopping of that habit, that is the experience of nirvana. That's the third noble truth. And that is something that we are then meant to affirm experientially. The stopping. Now, whether or not this occurs at some sort of magical moment after years of practice, then one day, bingo. That may be, in some cases, what happens. I think it's more likely that this is slowly a perspective that begins to grow upon us, something that we get familiar with, and something that suddenly we discover that we don't look at the world in the same way as we used to. And we may actually not notice that process of change very clearly at all. And this is, again, rather an odd thing in a sense. But again, the point of this process is not to experience moments in which this new perspective suddenly opens up. There's this sense that we don't have to be conditioned by these things. And not just an intellectual belief, but actually a felt sense that we can respond to the world from a different source altogether. And that is what leads, that is what begins the practice of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path begins there. It's at that point that we experience what is called stream entry. Finally, we've got to the stream. Okay. This is why I said I had to explain a few things before. Now, stream entry, you see, is entering the stream, and the stream which you enter is the Eightfold Path. The Buddha quite explicitly defines the stream as the Eightfold Path. So the moment, these moments of cessation or stopping, which come from fully knowing dukkha, letting go of craving, experiencing moments in which that process has stopped, that is the foundation upon which we then enter the path. We then practice the path. But of course, the path leads to mindfulness and concentration, which brings us back to fully knowing suffering and so on. And in that sense, we have a process. We have an unfolding process. And I think we need to stop in a minute and have a break. But perhaps we can just stop there, I think. There's a few things I want to say about stream entry, which we can save for a little bit later.
It just makes such beautiful sense.
Well, I think it makes sense. I mean, it's taken me an awful long time to somehow come to see the Buddha's teaching this way. But I find that this explanation has got a certain beautiful economy about it, and at the same time, it actually enables us to read some very classical materials mm-hmm. in a way that's entirely coherent with them. Makes them make sense in a way.
There's no transcendence in sight.
No transcendence at all. No mystical experience whatsoever. I mean, that might occur along this way. Why not? Fine. But that's not what it's about. That's not what it's about. And that doesn't mean that, in a sense, I think this is far more challenging and demanding, in a way, to live this way. I mean, I fail all the time. Constantly.
Well, if you're waiting to have a bit of transcendence before you get started, you'll never get started.
Well, that's also true, yes. And then again, we go into. Now we've got to this stream entry thing. We'll come back to it after the break. Okay, but let's just have a 10-minute break, stretch our legs, and then we'll come back and then open this up for discussion, and then we'll conclude. Hopefully, with a short period of meditation.
Can we stretch other things besides?
We can stretch whatever you like.